Welcome back, everyone, to another issue of Rabbit Hole Stories. And today we had Fernando on. He's the head of communications and just broadly head of marketing at Blockstream. And an amazing dude, Ian. That was...
Yeah, really cool guy.
Time just flew by. And when I checked the clock, I was like, oh, we're over an hour already because we kind of keep it short. And we talked about loads of things, Blockstream as a whole, his perception of the media, and especially how to talk to people who are not yet into Bitcoin. How did you like the episode?
Mate, really cool guy. I really liked the episode. I found it fascinating about the whole journey from Argentina to, his mum made the difficult decision to get them out of there. And we discussed a little bit about social politics and all that sort of stuff. So that's my bag. I love that sort of stuff. So that's what I really got from it. And I know you guys are going to enjoy this. But before we do, remember, if you're going to Prague, use that discount code RHSPOD. It's in the description with all the links and get your 10% off of BTC Prague. And we'll see you there. And as always, stay curious. Sorry about all the side chat, guys. Welcome back to yet another episode here at Rabbit Hole Stories. We've got the fantastic Fernando with us this week. Fernando, how's your day been so far, bro? And do you want to tell us who you are and what you're all about in the Bitcoin space, please, sir?
Yeah. I mean, I'm currently in Istanbul. I've been here for almost a month. So just enjoying the city, the food. I feel like I'm bloated as hell because everything comes with bread. And I think I told myself, like, okay, I'm going to cut out bread from my life. And that was like a week before we came down to Istanbul. So bad timing. But going through it right now, it's a super amazing day. The culture is nice and enjoying life. How about you guys?
Yeah, as they say, we're living the dream. And we've been trying to get you on the podcast for a while because I love your content on Bitcoin Twitter. You seem to be one of those people that speak quite honestly, and you've got a good sense of what's going on within the ecosystem and the sentiments that are out there. How did you get interested in doing that sort of stuff, and how's that evolving for you?
If you like my tweets, you should see my draft folder.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
it's full of fire that I have to keep it as a strategic, you know, ammunition. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. I think Bitcoin Twitter is a place that I owe a lot of my journey. A lot of people that I follow back in the days, I think I kind of discovered them on Twitter, and then from that touch point on, I went deeper into whatever content they were making. So the fact that you're saying that means a lot, so thanks a lot. In terms of my Bitcoin origin story, I think there's a lot of factors that come into play that once you get introduced to Bitcoin, you either get it or you don't, it sets a time for like how long you need in order to really grok it. I believe like Bitcoin is a very individual journey. You kind of like should at least take it as an autodidactical journey where you just sit down, you read, you consume content, you study it, and you kind of like take your time to unlearn a lot of the things that you have learned by being part of the public education system. But I think there was a lot of factors before all of that kind of like made it easy for me. And that is the fact that I'm from Argentina, and Argentina has had just a chronic problem with inflation and for decades and decades. So the fact that I was a kid back in 1989 where my mom chose to emigrate from Argentina to Norway because of a hyperinflationary dumpster fire that happened in 88 89, throughout my childhood as coming of age, I just kept going back to Argentina and seeing things just get worse and worse, and inflation always being a topic of conversation in the media, amongst families, among friends. So I was thinking to myself, like, what's going on here? Like, it's obvious that we know what the problem is. We all agree on the problem. Like, why can't we agree on fixing this, right? And also the fact that for the same reason that my mom emigrated in her late 20s, she was a very young mom, And I kept seeing families still emigrating, going to Spain, going to the US, going to anywhere, basically, trying to find better opportunities outside of Argentina. I was like, why does this keep repeating? What's going on here, really? So that led me into, you know, trying to understand what inflation is, because I kept hearing about it all the time, and then trying to understand the reasons of it. That led me to like my own personal path into discovering, you know, the Austrians. So like, you know, the classic Austrian economics authors and books. And then once a friend of mine introduced me to Bitcoin back in 2017, I would say it took me a little while to get a little bit in touch of the like the more technical stuff. And I, to this day, I'm kind of like, I am a perma noob, but I don't really have a super good grasp of the technical side of Bitcoin, but I understood it from like a monetary principle. So that was kind of like it. And then from then you try to like go into, you choose different rabbit holes and you try to like learn more about the things that concerns you, that you're interested in, that or at least is connected to something that you're interested in. And yeah, I mean, that rabbit hole journey continues to this day. So it's something wonderful that I think I'm very appreciative of, the fact that I discovered Bitcoin, but also appreciative of the fact that you get exposure to so many bright minds and so many, it's just good people. So it's, big life moment for me personally, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess if you lack technical understanding, you kind of work at the right company, so it's just one message away to... to see what's going on.
In every company chat where I have a question, I'm easily the biggest idiot in the chat. But I think that's a really privileged position to be in, too, because then you have so many great people that you can learn from and soak up knowledge from. So yeah, it's a super privileged place to be in.
Yeah, I always remember the HBO series, The Newsroom, with Jeff Daniels, where he's, in one of the episodes, he's the greater fool. And I think it's always better to be the greater fool instead of someone being the front runner and, you know, having to explain yourself probably 1,000 times until people get it. Just geographically speaking, that's a very interesting childhood you had, from South America up to the north of Europe, essentially. If you look at it now, looking back with the Bitcoin knowledge, what is sort of the biggest difference for you between Argentina and Norway? Or is there any? Are we more close to each other than what we think?
Like the differences between the two with the Bitcoin lens, you mean?
Yeah, monetary speaking, economically speaking.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the monetary stuff and the technical aspects of Bitcoin is kind of like one of the two main factors that a lot of people look into Bitcoin with. But I think culture is one kind of like underappreciated aspect of both Bitcoin, but also the fact, you know, looking at the differences between Norway and Argentina. Culture drives everything, man. Like, culture drives technology. Culture drives monetary properties. Like the culture kind of like dictates what is going to be prioritized at any given moment, right? So if the culture of a certain place is you know, closer to corruption and kind of like you know, hustling the next guy or something like that, then all the technologies and all the properties of the local currency will definitely reflect that, if that is you know, a culture that has penetrated all levels, right? Like to politicians, to the smallest you know, individual level. And but if you're a culture where like hard work is you know, respected, and it's kind of like the thing that people are chasing, and you have a collective mindset of like you want to bring the country forward, then the local currency will be better. You will have more, what do you call it? You will have people at the helm that are more responsible. So I think that's like the difference between Argentina and Norway, to be honest, is the culture. In Argentina, sadly, there was a time where hard work and building things were the DNA of the country. But that was like in a time and space where immigration from Europe was very fresh. There's a lot of people that came to Argentina from Europe with this sense of like, let's build this country, right? Kind of like the same, you know, we share that history with the United States, basically. So you can basically look at Buenos Aires and New York City. They had the same influx of the same type of immigrants at the same time, and they all came with that, like, mentality, right? Sadly, that mentality is gone. That's not part of the culture in Argentina anymore. Things have definitely changed. So it is, you know, sad to see. But Norway, on the other hand, was always like a very poor country, a small country, before they, you know, magically discovered black gold back in the 60s and the 70s. So the culture there is more like hardworking. We got to keep the community strong because they needed the community. They were poor as fuck. So and like stealing from other people or just being corrupt, stuff like that, was just frowned upon, you know. And still to this day, that culture has somehow, I mean, native Norwegians would probably say, okay, things have changed, and I'm sure they have, but the big ticket is still this. And that I think is the biggest difference between Norwegians and Argentinians, and maybe Northern Europeans and South Americans in a larger scale as well.
One thing I'm curious about and sort of like always thinking about is social economic structures and socialism, capitalism, Austrian economics, all this sort of stuff. And when you mention culture, it kind of brings it up for me in the sense that I wonder if in some way culture is connected in some way to the design of the fiat system in some way. Is culture like a design? Because in the UK, we've got this famous saying, keep calm and carry on. And it was about 10 years ago. That was everywhere. There was bags with it. Everyone wanted a poster with it, with the painting of the Queen. And in the background is a keep calm and carry on. And that's kind of like the British mantra, if you like. And I'm just wondering whether that's kind of propaganda in a way, part of the culture that we've been sort of ushered in to believe in, that that's who we are as a society. And I'm just wondering whether you've ever had any similar thoughts to that.
Yeah, man, that's a good anecdote. I mean, that's kind of like the very opposite of like, yeah, revolution now, let's fucking fuck shit up and, you know, let's rebel against the system. It's the opposite of raging against the machine. And I think that is definitely, you can see differences between Europeans as well, right? Like you have the French that really loves to fuck shit up, and the Scandis are, I don't know, has there ever been a fucking revolution in Scandinavia ever? Everything was pretty peaceful. Sweden used to be like in a union with Norway, Denmark as well, but they were kind of like just tossing Norway around. There weren't really any battles being fought, with the exception of when the Germans invaded Norway in the Second World War. There was some resistance there, but like, I think it's just embedded in the culture just to keep shit quiet and don't make a fuss because things are very dire. But then again, like in Latin America, things are even more dire and people don't think twice about like, you know, shutting down a street or doing mass protest in the street and kind of like rebelling. I don't know. It's there's many layers to this, obviously, but I think just in terms of culture, there's a type of people that are more rambunctious and other people that are more chill. And I think this is very hard to shake off. You will maybe see some degrees of distance from the most extreme cases. The more comfortable you get, the more richer you get, you probably, you know, sway away from that route. But I think these are like differences that are embedded in anyone, and it will reflect on whatever they invent, whatever system they try to create, whatever they want to do. I do think, though, to be honest with you, you know, the invention of the fiat system or the invention of democracy, whatever, was done in the West, right? Like these are concepts that were created by the political class in ancient Greece or the political class in the, you know, modern Western hemisphere. And it came out of a combination of necessity and yeah, part of the culture and the way they thought things were correctly done. But I'm starting to think less and less that these systems are good for the entire world. I honestly think there's a couple of countries who might not need democracy the way, you know, we think democracy is, or that, you know, obviously the fiat system could be a thing that could potentially be responsibly done, but you have the temptation of printing more money is just going to be so much greater for an Argentinian because of the culture than, I don't know, a Norwegian because of their culture, right? That temptation is strong when you are kind of, you know, corrupt already, right? If that makes sense. So these are systems that are not perfect, obviously. I mean, we are Bitcoiners, so we definitely have our issues with the fiat system, no matter how close to 2% inflation per year they are. But there are responsible ways of running that system and irresponsible ways of running that system. And I think, you know, cultures who aren't Western, they are more irresponsible. That's just the way it is. So you would think, well, do they need this system then? If things really go bad, maybe other systems should be implemented instead. I don't know. That's kind of like what I'm thinking about these days. Sorry for the rants. Well, don't want to like bore you guys with a history lesson, but I can give you like a short like summary of what happened in the years before. So we had a very famous, well, to some people famous, president called Perón, and of course Evita, which is more famous, coming to power in the late 40s, early 50s, right? So this is a guy who did something very, damn, props to this guy for pulling it off, though. He was a guy who, like a military dude, he was a general in the military that was inspired by Franco in Spain, from Mussolini in Italy, and, you know, you get where I'm going with this. And so he was, like, in love with their system, which was the fascist system. So when he came into power in Argentina, he wanted to recreate that. He wanted to recreate, you know, Mussolini's Italy in Argentina. But the way that he did it wasn't using like fascist rhetoric. He managed to do a fascist system, which is, I think if you look up the definition of fascism, it's something along the lines of like a totalitarian system that runs a government like enterprise. You know, it's a big enterprise. He did that. He achieved that. So he basically nationalized every single thing, all the industries, all the economy. He basically nationalized, which was the industries that these immigrants that I talked about 5 minutes ago came to Argentina to build from the private sector. So he took completely control of that. But he used that using left-wing socialist rhetoric, which is mind-boggling. Like, how can you be a right-wing fascist, but you? Your actions are right-wing fascist, but your words are left-wing socialist. It's like incredible. Anyway, so it's all about the plea to the most poor. Like, we have to have a welfare state. We have to have human rights. We have to have essential rights. Blah blah blah, and all of that is a ploy just to print more money and give that money away and have the people depending on that money being printed. Especially right before you have an election, right? So he kind of like started all of that and, you know, managed to be such a influential figure that even after his death, other politicians came into power using that rhetoric and using his image. So this is late 40s, early 50s, all the way to like 76. There's a lot of turmoil before that, a couple of military dictatorship that also happened because the militaries were like fighting between themselves. But in 76, the last junta came into power. They stayed into power until 1983, which is kind of like the year where all Argentinians say we came back to democracy. From that year, from 1983 to 1989, we changed the capital from Buenos Aires to a place called Viedma, random. And then they were like, that's a bad idea. Let's 180 that. Let's go back to Buenos Aires. They changed the name of the currency and said, no, that was a bad idea too. Let's put that back. So it was so much like fuckery happening in the years after 1983 that Argentina was just in a very, very bad shape. Inflation went, I don't know how many thousand percents. So at that time in 88, 89, my mom was like, she was 27 years old, 26 years old, young mom. She was like, this is just unbearable. So she left, the rest of my family stayed. And it was basically because of this socialist factions that always managed to have the power, with the exception of that military dictatorship, because they were obviously right wing. They always came into power and just fucked up the money. And so, yeah, you can say that in a way it was, you know, she left because of socialism, but it was just like the way socialists manage money. That was basically the reason. And of course, they manage money in a terrible way. So that was pretty much it.
Is a lot of that, you know, history also one of the key reasons Milei won? Because, you know, if you read the mainstream media, they're all telling you how bad he is and how extreme he is. There was actually a
far
German
right,
newspaper
isn't
that quoted... Yeah, I mean, everyone is far right these days. But there was a German newspaper that quoted, if he got paid by SIL, the, you know, the chainsaw company, because he always used them. Like shit like this, they just made up at the end of the day. But could you maybe give us a deep dive into what Milei means for a lot of Argentinians? Because there are still some things, if you actually read his economical stuff, where you go, we'll see if it pays out. But I guess generally speaking, he must have been one of the few Argentinians that went, no, fuck this, we actually need a revolution.
Yeah, no, totally. And I did a podcast with Breedlove the other day where I said exactly that, and I have tweeted about this as well. And it's like, okay, you know, Milei is a very interesting guy. He definitely knows how to speak and can, you know, all these Austrian arguments have always, like, historically been very academic. So, you know, when you explain things in a very academic way, you instantly put up a barrier between you and normies, right? So, you know, historically, these theories haven't really been popular, right? But he managed to crack the code, right? He was able to sneak in, you know, Mises and Rothbard and all kinds of good stuff through becoming this living, breathing meme almost, right? So he cracked the code, and I think that's huge. Now he's a politician, right? He's a president, so he is inside of a system that runs on compromises, right? It runs on deals, it runs on trade-offs between different factions, right? So he won't be able to do everything that he has said that he will do. So I'm not really like at the edge of my seat waiting for like a lot of the stuff that he said he will do. But like I said before, the cultural change is what is needed, right? Like I said in the beginning of our conversation, culture drives everything. It drives the decisions that you make, the inventions that you make, the technology that you want to bet on, everything. So if he, after these 4 years, is able to continue to, you know, fight that cultural fight, the cultural battle, and then if he gets reelected and gets another 4 years to do that, man, I'm super optimistic about Argentina, because most than anything, it needs a drastic cultural change. And then if he can blow up the central bank in the process, okay, hell yeah, I would welcome that. But anything else that he can do is a plus, but I really think the cultural change is the priority. And I think, to be honest, judging by his 2, 3, 4 months, he is really doing a lot of things that is forcing people to think about the current state of the country. So I'm hopeful for that. But in terms of like promises, hey, it's a politician. Let's not forget that, you know. So let's keep our hopes pretty low.
With Austrian economics, am I right in thinking there's like in that theory there's minimal government intervention in that economic structure, or is it essential that there is some kind of political structure involved? And the reason why I'm asking that is because it seems like a lot of people in the Bitcoin Twitter ecosystem are relatively divided about politicians who support and mention Bitcoin as a good thing or a bad thing. And there's a constant debate about, oh, it's a politician, like we're against it, separate money from state. And there's kind of this sort of like to-ing and fro-ing between politicians putting some sort of positive spin on Bitcoin and whether that is a good thing. And I'm just wondering if you've got any kind of thoughts or feelings about that personally.
Well, I don't know, man. I think the best money usually wins from the bottom up. So it doesn't really come from the opposite. Like, it doesn't come through a decree, it doesn't come through a standard or any law that a politician passes. It just organically happens. So obviously I prefer that way, because then apart from the best money being used, you also, the users of that money have a high degree of conviction as well. And they're not using it because otherwise they will be penalized with punishment, right? But then again, that's also hoping for a lot when it comes to humanity, because humans are fucking busy dealing with their own shit, and they don't have the time to sit down and, a lot of people, they might use Bitcoin out of necessity, out of like very, you know, dark place, very dark situation. So there's very many different ways to look at it. The one thing that I'm looking at it is like, hey, I'm all about hyper-Bitcoinization, right? Like I work at a place that creates infrastructure for this technology, and we are looking at many, many use cases, right? So we want to create infrastructure for many different things. And I think hyper-Bitcoinization isn't, 8 billion people paying for their groceries with Bitcoin using Lightning. I think hyper-Bitcoinization looks and feels very differently than what it currently is right now. And we got to build for all types of scenarios, all types of people, people that hate each other, people that love each other. So some of that usage or some of that like cohort of users will probably come from a precedent like Bukele shilling Bitcoin like crazy and passing a legal tender law. Yep, that's fine. But then there will be other countries that will adopt Bitcoin out of straight up necessity, like Nigeria. That's fine too. I mean, everything is good for Bitcoin. I think it's kind of like stupid to think that no. Adoption needs to happen in these stages, in these phases, exactly how I want it. And not only should they adopt Bitcoin, but they should use it at a certain way that I agree with as well. And I think those type of Bitcoiners, they really they miss the forest for the trees. They really fail to see the big picture. And I think it's a huge disconnect that a lot of Bitcoiners have with just humans, humanity. I think people need to maybe travel more, maybe
get their mums off more.
It's about the people that you listen to and the content that you curate for yourself at the end of the day, right? Like you have 24 hours in a day. You're going on Twitter, you're going to these places to read, to learn, to interact with people. You got to be very picky. You got to be super good at curating that stuff. And a lot of people, they think they are not a slave to the algorithm, but they are, man. But they don't know it. So a lot of these ways of thinking, they tend to dominate at certain times. But I think the solution is just build the tools, have people understand the trade-offs of doing things on other layers, learn about other value props, other use cases. And I think, hey, if a certain use case is not for you, that's cool, but that doesn't mean it's not for other people as well. So people just need to accept that, you know. And I have good hopes, man. I think we're way more mature in 2024 than we were in 2017. So I think we're on the right path.
Yeah, definitely. And isn't it ironic that like most of these hardcore Bitcoiners who go by the rule of you have to use Bitcoin the way I do, either work for the same company from one giant part of the Bitcoin adoption, or they're just buddies on Twitter, you know? So you kind of go again with this whole culture and social thing where they like stick together and try to drive these narratives. And also when you mentioned 8 billion people using Bitcoin over Lightning, my mind went, this is what I sometimes read by people explaining that they orange pill somebody. What does orange pilling actually mean at the end of the day? Because if you just tried them to convince to download, let's go with Blockstream Green, for example, with a good Lightning wallet, and they go there and then they go, oh yeah, I have like $50 worth of Bitcoin. In my book, okay, they have a touch point with Bitcoin, but maybe they have other viewpoints about it and stuff. And I think we sometimes in the Bitcoin landscape fall down these own narratives we build. And I'm not going to use every tool in my arsenal to make a connection there to what you do with your Bitcoin perception blog, because this is sometimes what we criticize the media for, like, oh, you know, fudsters and all of these things. But if you then look a bit behind the scenes, we kind of go like, yeah, we do the same thing. But what was the motivation for you to actually start that? And it's not just the block where you go like, oh yeah, that's what they said. You also do all of that research, you provide the data and such. How did you get started there?
Okay, yeah, cool. I just want to touch on a couple of things that you said before asking me that question. So if I derive, please remind me of that question and we can talk about Bitcoin perception. But I think, to be fair, people who work at Bitcoin companies, they kind of like, they meet with the engineers, with the product people every day, right? They have very deep discussions about the product. So as a result of that, they have a very deeper understanding of the product than maybe somebody out there who's not at the company, right? Like, I get this with many of our products as well at Blockstream, right? Take Liquid, for example. Now we are definitely having a momentum for Liquid. I think more people are starting to understand like what kind of trade-offs the specific Liquid is as a layer two is versus the base layer. We have more people, more influencers actually creating content, user generated content about Liquid. And I see that, oh shit, they are really understanding. I'm actually learning from them and kind of like seeing very small, but very specific use cases that I didn't think about, for example. And that's a super healthy thing. So there's like people shilling their own products because they work at a company. Yeah, of course, there's a business incentive behind it. Yes. But I also think, to be fair with them, that we are dealing with a lot of novel technology here, and people that work with them in day in and day out, they have a different vision than somebody who maybe follows that company on Twitter and reads some tweets every day. So what I'm trying to say is, I love the fact that more Bitcoin companies are popping up everywhere in the world, that many Bitcoin companies that started like a couple of cycles back are still around today and are, you know, they have had the chance to develop their technology to be really, really good, or at least better than when they started. So I think that the way that we will get to hyper Bitcoinization or whatever, or orange pilling the world, will be through businesses being able to communicate their value props through marketing. By the way, let's give props to Bitcoin marketers who can kind of like cut through the noise and distill like, this is what you want to do, this is how the tool is helping you do it, so you get the job done, and that's why you need to use this specific tool. And then we kind of like, you know, we quantify that as we go along. Sorry, Joel, you wanted to chime in.
And this sometimes means, and I know this is something like hardcore OG, well, not hardcore OGs, hardcore ex-Karens on Bitcoin Twitter like to go about. I literally had the other day, my boss had to send me a message like, just ignore it, don't reply to the tweet. And I kind of go, this is the inner journalist in me, where I have to be right at this moment, or I have to go into the debate, where I go, no, he just doesn't get what you just said. It takes businesses for these things to adopt. And yeah, this sometimes means that you use a business strategy to convince people of Bitcoin, because this is what we need to do at the end of the day. We need to show the advantages. And yeah, this sometimes means that you need to pick out a trick of your marketing box and you go out there and you use other strategies that are maybe not grassroots, but at the end of the day, they contribute to, you know, having more people using Bitcoin. Isn't that the goal we all should use?
Yeah, no, and also like the entire space is also, I mean, this is Bitcoin, right? So it kind of like has become, it is a very contrarian space. So a lot of the people who are looking at your technology will look at it with a contrarian lens. Kind of like, I'm just going to be against it just because, right? That's kind of like the modus operandi. And then you got to start from there and kind of like chip at it slowly over time. And then maybe they will get around to it. Maybe never they will get around to it. Maybe their beef is actually not the product, but the people behind it. So like, I had an opinion piece on Bitcoin Magazine last year, I think it was now, that was basically Bitcoin is not for everyone, right? For the same reason that a lot of people will just like hate on Bitcoin just because, a lot of people that are Bitcoiners will hate certain companies or certain products just because. So they have their own very personal conviction of like what is right and wrong in this world. And to shake that, I rather spend my time and energy on people who are more open, who aren't so entrenched into their own convictions. And, you know, ultimately, Bitcoiners aren't really special. We're all humans, right? And humans have this like defense mechanism where we have so much shit going on every single day that we need to be very careful about what we believe in, how much time we spend on learning new stuff. we got to be, we manage our time very carefully, right? So if you already have like a life, you can see life through a very special lens, you're kind of content with that lens. You're like, hey, I understand life. Life makes sense to me when I see it through this lens. If somebody comes from the left and say, no, 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 this lens is completely wrong. You're idiots for thinking that this is the truth. Here is Bitcoin, and you're gonna like learn this, and you're gonna unlearn everything that you have learned through 10, 15 years of school. That is not an easy task, right? So the same logic applies to Bitcoiners who have been here since 2015, 16, 17. They have had so much time to make up their mind about something that to shake them out of that belief, it's maybe not worth it, man. Maybe it's better to just go to a cohort or a group of people that are, because of their situation, they're more ready, right? And I say this about just orange pilling in general. I don't want to spend my time orange pilling, trying to or convince the Guardian journalist about Bitcoin when there's probably some kid in Argentina with a laptop that is dreaming about getting a remote work and providing, getting, I don't know, dollar exposure through work. I'd rather spend my time with that guy teaching him about Bitcoin and Lightning and getting paid in Bitcoin through remote work. I think that is like way better time spent, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I genuinely believe like half of the Bitcoin Twitter people who respond to Jemima Kelly for any article she puts out on Bitcoin are either because they fancy her, you know, or they just like to go into this debate. But having said that, though, this is again where personality and culture kicks in. I know from myself, I need to like close my laptop, have my phone in another room at the end of the day, because I could be a dick on purpose sometimes. And it's funny to like, you know, trigger the Karens or whoever is actually in your replies. But yeah, it definitely has a lot of point that everyone has to start anywhere. And we all have our histories and all of our backgrounds. But to get back on track, how did you start the Bitcoin Perception newsletter / research lab? Is that a fair way to say it?
I mean, if you want to be fancy about it, yeah, maybe I can steal that from you.
Talking about marketing.
We're a research firm. Yeah, we can maybe brainstorm a couple of definitions later, and then I can put you as a co-founder. The thing about Bitcoin Perception is that I lead the marketing communications team at Blockstream, right? So it's something I'm thinking about all the time. And I came to a point where I was like, I feel like there's something happening in the mainstream media. Like I'm starting to see like inbound requests, right? Like, hey, I want to interview Adam Back, for example, right? From these new names that I didn't really know, or from like, I'm talking about reporters, right? But then also from like outlets that I was like, these people have kind of like been hostile to Bitcoin previously, just from like the back of my mind. Why are they interested in Blockstream, Bitcoin, or Adam Back for that matter? And I was thinking, it would be good to like check a reporter or an outlet's history of Bitcoin coverage and kind of like get a feel of like, have these people been negative, balanced, positive, and then for certain time frames. And I was kind of like looking for a solution or like a research lab or something that could tell me very quickly whether, quick reply to these questions. And I didn't, so I built it. That's you know, necessity is the mother of all inventions, right? So I was like, okay, I'm going to build this. I'm going to start tracking the 40 biggest mainstream media outlets globally in English. And I'm going to just, every time they mention the word Bitcoin in a video or a publication, I'm going to track that. And yeah, I started doing that. There's a bunch of like hacky shit that I had to just ChatGPT my way through, but it's a pretty solid system now that every time somebody writes or makes a video about Bitcoin, I get like a new row in my spreadsheet, and I see this every single day. And then I took that data and I made it into a dashboard so I can kind of like go through the data pretty quickly and pretty smoothly. And when I started seeing that dashboard, I was like, yo, this is nice. I need to put this visual somewhere. So I was like, okay, let me create a Twitter account where I just tweet about my findings. And then that quickly also pivoted to, apart from the Twitter account, also start creating research reports. And I think there's a lot of activity. So I think a weekly report is justified, So that's what I've been doing. I started that 5 months ago. And yeah, I have about 1,300 followers on Twitter and a little bit over 1,000 subscribers in total, subscribing to my newsletter. So I think it's a really good start and a nice little signal of like other people other than me also thinking that this was something that they needed in their life. So
that's really, really cool, mate. And so what sort of trends and biases are happening then since you started it? Is there any sort of things that are happening that are fascinating to you or something you didn't expect now that this is something you're focused on?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I saw, which, I mean, there's a lot of let me backtrack here. As a Bitcoiner, I think you already have like a strong opinion about what the press is, right? So yeah. it's going to be negative, right? So I was like catching myself as I was looking at the data, like, damn, I have a very negative view of the mainstream media, because as I was going through the data, I saw like nice articles. And I'm tracking, it's not like I started tracking when I started 5 months ago and I only have 5 months worth of data. I have data from January 1st, 2018, all the way up to here, right? So I was looking at stuff like that was written back in 2018, 2019. And there was like some really in-depth stuff from Al Jazeera that, you know, covered, I think it was like a hydro dam in China. And they were like, they sent reporters down there, took some pictures of the workers that were like literally sleeping there overnight and like had like a coverage of that. I can't remember which company it was or even if they're still existing, but that was like back in, that's 2018. That's like ancient history in Bitcoin time, right? So I was like, what happened to those stories, right? Like what, why did they kind of like disappear and became all fuddy? And then when I was looking at newer stuff, I was like, okay, now there's like a new generation of reporters that are kind of like coming into this business or this space. And they are writing about Bitcoin with genuine curiosity. Like they're not really out there to do hit pieces, which is like, okay, this is what I thought the mainstream media was doing. Like, okay, when we do cover Bitcoin, it is going to be negative. So I started seeing this like early 2018, a lot of like, you know, natural curiosity pieces was being made. Then it was like I don't know what happened in between. And then now these more in-depth things are coming back. So it's like, okay, this is something that I just need to really look more into. And then, you know, ever since I have been trying to tweet and write in my newsletter about the findings that I discover. Another thing that is also very recent is like the halving. Like since Q4 last year, the halving started to be a term that you see in publications and in videos and like, you know, CNBC newsrooms, they're talking about the halving, trying to like understand what it is. And then they say stuff like, oh, it's a software upgrade. You know, it's Bitcoin software upgrade. Like weird terms, but you can see they're trying to understand. They're not like, ah, it's shit, this is mining, oh, it's bad for the environment. No. They're trying to be like, let's talk about the halving. Let's try to go deeper into understanding it in a way that makes sense. And I think that's great. And so, you know, I think a lot of Bitcoiners, they need to change their minds a little bit. And hopefully my data can provide that transparency so they can actually see that, hey, the tides are kind of changing. There's a new generation of younger people coming into this space that are looking at Bitcoin and trying to cover it in a neutral, curious way. Not to say that the usual suspects are not writing their hit pieces. Yes, they are, but it's just not a monolith anymore. It's not just one thing. So I think this fragmentation is very interesting, especially when we are where we are in the adoption cycle. And I think it's important that people can track it and actually visualize it.
Yeah, 100%. And this is one of the things I see in my day job, probably every hour, because, you know, I am very active in contact with a lot of the journals. I'm very lucky that I actually am fluent in German, English and French, which sort of aligns also with the vision of what Relay wants to do in the next couple of months and years. And often when I speak to them, it's always a negative event they had. You know, I literally spoke to someone from Handelsblatt earlier this week, and she went, I had people at an event in Berlin screaming at me why she had a typo in a Bitcoin article. And I kind of went, I suspect the people, you know, who could it be? And I asked her, and then she just had some misconceptions. She genuinely didn't understand like why the halving was taking place and why the different, like a difficulty adjustment happens and all of these things. And I just broke it down to the simplest barrier, explaining it to like a 5-year-old. And she went, this is for the first time where someone genuinely was interested in actually, you know, talking to me. And I kind of went, oh, fuck, this is sad. And then I have other events, you know, at like media events when you go there, where people who might cover crypto more generally or broadly, and they then see the difference. And, you know, a lot of times I just give them a fair point where they go like, it loses a lot of energy. I go, yeah, that's undebatable. You know, we can't change that fact, but you have to look at the way it's being used and especially how you compare that data, right? If you compare it to the banking sector, to data centers as a whole, this is a fraction of what's being used. And, you know, talking about environmental issues and stuff, compare it to gold. Like, how's gold being mined? What does it take compared to Bitcoin? And if you, the more you do these kind of things, the more they go, oh, now I get what you mean. And this is all I want to have, because that's where curiosity kicks in and where they go, I need to find out more about this. And I genuinely believe that most people who work at these outlets, if they don't have a senior level, they're not interested in writing thought pieces. They're not interested in sitting at a shitty cubicle all day long and, you know, having to write yet another bad article. But they're interested in finding out more, which is sort of a positive spin on the whole journalism journalism world as a whole. Because if a lot of Bitcoiners, I'm convinced, get a peek behind it, you would not want to live in that world any minute of the day, because it is quite sad and it is quite miserable. So props to you that you actually also give this opportunity to fellow Bitcoiners to learn more. And I'm curious if you sometimes see these articles going out now that you've sort of peeked behind the curtain, do you still react emotionally because you go, ah, fuck it, still haven't got it? Or are you a bit more calm where you go, okay, this might be that angle or that angle. And I don't know, maybe haven't gotten in touch with one of these journals who have written these, let's call them hit pieces or badly informed research papers.
It depends on my mood of the day, man. If I'm triggered by something, then I'm triggered by this as well.
Yeah.
No, I think that
this is where you get the Fernando fuck you emails.
Exactly. No, I mean, also just to touch on a couple of things that you said. Like, I mean, yeah, there are some journalists who just want to do great stories and they want to feel free, they want to be autonomous and whatever. But let's be real, there are journalists who just do this as a day job and they're kind of like monkeys behind a keyboard, and like if the editorial desk tells them no, this is something bad, because we saw that, you know, Greenpeace, they just released this report, you got to cover it, and this has to be you know, a negative sentiment article, and then people will do it. They're, you know, most people are like that. So there's a mix of like individual reporters who have their own convictions, but they might, like you said, they might be senior, so they have more autonomy and they can choose their own stories. And then the majority are not, right? They are just trying to like work the corporate ladder, and they do as they told. So, but that's also why it's important to have this data, right? So that you can actually choose the name of a reporter. You can go to the Bitcoin Perception dashboard and literally choose the reporter's name. It's not an outlet level, well, that too, but you can also choose an individual reporter and kind of like follow the timeline of like, is this mostly negative, mostly balanced, mostly positive, or all three? But yeah, in terms of like educating journalists and, you know, orange pilling them in a way, which I think your question is about, it's kind of like the same, to be honest, it's the same approach that you should have with like orange pilling people in general. Pick carefully who you want to orange pill. Like I said in the beginning of our convo, I'm not spending too much time on the Daily Mail and the Guardian. Sorry. I mean, the British newspapers are pretty bad. Sorry, Ian. I'm not saying anything you don't know from before, but the Brits are embarrassingly bad at this. And you look at like, also there's like the silence is also speaking volume, right? Like if you go to my dashboard and you look at the Financial Times coverage of Bitcoin, for example, and it is minimum, like almost non-existent. And you would think like, holy shit, like your Financial Times, you should like with something like Bitcoin, which is like the eighth or the seventh largest asset in the world, it deserves to be covered by a financial publication of the status of the FT, but they choose not to. I think that speaks volumes.
especially the fucking, what's it called, Bonneville block, or what they always rebrand the fucking block about. They missed the mark. Let's call it what it is. They I think the first time I heard about it or read in it was 2014, before it turned into like this super fashion high conglomerate media block. And I know people who've written this stuff. I go like, how can you miss this? And they go like, oh, you know, I actually bought my cocaine with Bitcoin. And I go like, fucking hypocrite at the end of the day. Like, you, first of all, kids don't do drugs. And if you do, like, please don't do it in large conglomerates, and don't pay for it with Bitcoin, because it's stupid. And on the other end of the day, like, you write about it being drug money, and then you use it to buy drugs, and you still miss the mark on what potential it has. But then again, you know, that's where ego kicks in, because they want to be the cool, hip media guy, or girl, in this case. And just want to either bash it all day long, or be the different editorial team in the newsroom.
Yeah, and I think also, like, a lot of, they might be salty no coiners at the end of the day, right? Like, they know they missed the train, and they're like, ah, man, okay, I have a personal vendetta against this, because I did know about it in 2013, and if I could, if I had, bought Bitcoin back then, it would have been a different story. Well, maybe they probably would have sold in 2014 when it was like $150, but still, you know what I mean? Like, they have kind of like been sitting on the sideline for so long with this specific attitude that they're not going to be shaken and think differently right now. So that's why it is important to kind of like catch the new names as early as possible, and like have that as part of your like communication strategy, where you're like, hey, I see that you're a new name at Bloomberg and you're writing a lot of cool pieces. Let me just open the door for you. And that, you know, for example, at Blockstream, we have done that, right? Like, we have something that we call a media briefing, right? So we invite the press to just hop on a Zoom with us. It's not live streamed, or it's just an internal call. And they can just come and ask questions, but we also show them, like, this is what we're building, this is who it's for, this is why we think it's important. And then that's it. Write a story if you want. We try to put some nuggets there so they can kind of like pick it up. And they do. They did in the last one. But it's mostly just to bring them closer, and just to know that, hey, you know, at least this is one company in the Bitcoin space who are doing good things. And whether they believe it in or not, I don't know. I can't really care too much about it. The important thing is what I can do, what I can control, or us as Blockstream, what we can control is creating that forum, creating that platform so that people can come, see what we are working on, and ask any questions that they want. And, you know, stuff like that, I think it's important to do. And if you catch these new reporters early, they're going to, first of all, they're going to like the attention. They're going to be like, okay, you're inviting me to this special thing. Okay, yeah, they're going to come. But then it's their mandate to learn the most about this industry. So they will say yes to something like that. And then you might be able to influence their coverage a little bit, at least, you know, not like influence in a manipulative way, but just influence them in terms of facts, and then not really pushing any narrative, just like presenting what we're doing, and then they can drive their own conclusions, and driving, nurturing that relationship from the early start, I think, is going to pay off big time for companies like Blockstream and other people who choose this type of strategy in the next, 3, 4, 5 years and beyond. Because these reporters will become senior, and you know, at that, when they get to that phase, they will hopefully have a good impression of certain players in the Bitcoin space. So they won't be affected by other news, other negative headlines. Because a lot of these journalists, they do that. Like, I have so many journalists that I'm trying to like reach out to, which just, they ghost me, but I know that they keep creating certain stories. And I see that also in Bitcoin Perception dashboard, that they kind of like, they copy paste headlines from each other. They copy paste paragraphs and put it into the article. So they look at each other more than they look at us. So we gotta like say, hey, we're here, like drive attention to us. And hopefully influence them in that way. And that's kind of like the healthy, best way to do it, even though it's a very slow-moving train and it's going to take a lot. It's a very long-term strategy. But I think that's sustainable and what we should do. But hey, I can only control what we do at Blockstream. I can't speak for the entire Bitcoin space, but I do hope that more companies are taking that approach. I think it's the best approach to take.
That's really cool, inviting these mainstream media or journalists into opening your doors, right? And I think your main title on your website is Rethinking Trust, right? So you're trying to invite these people in and reveal this open source technology and the work that you're doing in the ecosystem at Blockstream. What exactly is Blockstream, and what is it you're trying to do there?
Well, Blockstream is an infrastructure company, a Bitcoin infrastructure company. So everything that we build is on top of Bitcoin. Adam and his co-founders back in 2014, the whole raison d'être, the Blockstream was, we had to scale Bitcoin in layers, right? So it's more about the Linux philosophy, the kind of that type of layered architecture thinking that led them to create Blockstream to pursue these technologies and build stuff like sidechains, Lightning, right? We have our own implementation of Lightning, but then also later on, we develop our own wallet. We have our hardware wallet later on, and we kind of do it all. We have a hardware wallet. We do satellites. We transmit the Bitcoin blockchain through satellites. We do mining. We do many different things within mining. There's a lot of things that we do. I think in any aspect of Bitcoin, I think Blockstream is working on something in that little pocket. So. And it's one of the longest living Bitcoin only companies, right? Like I said, founded in 2014, so that's 10 years. And we're just trying to push Bitcoin forward with new and exciting things. That's basically it.
That's brilliant. And the work at Blockstream is very, very fascinating, and the development there is most definitely, because you get a lot of debate about what layer twos are, what is built on top of Bitcoin. But I think at Blockstream, you're really sort of sticking to the pure sort of relating it directly back to Bitcoin without any of the obscure sort of other side chains, this and the other going on, right? Are you sort of sticking fundamentally to just building directly on top of Bitcoin and other solutions?
Yeah, no, we do also do work on Bitcoin Core, right? We have a research team as well, and we many contributors to Bitcoin Core has either been employed at Blockstream at one point or received sponsorship or grants from Blockstream. So both the base layer and other layers, we have built stuff or participated or contributed to. In terms of what is a real layer two, I don't think there's a consensus on what a real layer two is. So anyone who says this is not a real layer two, this is a real layer two, that whatever thing that they're pointing to is just their own conviction. There's really no consensus. This is just a very subjective opinion, right? You can't unilaterally exit, for example. That is one of the things that I keep hearing about, but it's not really a good definition of it. It is not a catch-all. It might be one criteria of many, but I think that is kind of the point, right? I think some people, they just love to debate what is a real layer two forever, but most people understand trade-offs and just use the tools. And I think that's the people that I want to talk to, right? Bitcoiners is just a weird people, man. On one side, Nick Bhatia's book Layered Money gets all the praise in the world because it kind of explains how money actually works best in layers. But once you introduce layers to Bitcoin, no, then all of a sudden that's not good. But then if you want to do stuff on Bitcoin, that's not good neither. So I don't know. I think that Liquid, Lightning, Mercury Layer, projects like those, Rootstock even, are real serious projects. And then unfortunately, maybe because of Liquid, Rootstock, and Lightning, and now it has become a fad to say I'm a Bitcoin layer two company, so maybe we should pat ourselves on the back for making Bitcoin layer two a hot thing because there's so many shit chains that are just putting that brand on themselves to maybe get another funding round. I don't know. So that is kind of like a thing right now that I'm not the biggest fan of. I think this is eventually a fad that will die like any other fads. But Liquid is definitely not part of that. Even though many people might say, oh shit, anyone is calling anything a layer two, can't put Liquid in that category. There's certain projects that you need to look at extra hard. Not even extra hard, just look at them and you will see. It's not a layer two branding exercise like many of these other companies are doing nowadays. So, you know, I take that criticism very... I laugh at that, to be honest. I don't entertain it too much, even though I fall victim to that, and I do engage in some minor flame wars on Twitter with somebody. But I think the majority of people are understanding stuff like Mercury Layer and Liquid way more better than they did a couple of years ago, and they're just using it. They're using the tools. They're building. Companies are building stuff on top of these layers, and it's just an exciting ecosystem. And I, you know, it's very very good to see.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're still so. I know it sounds corny, but we're still so early in the process that we can experiment with these different thought principles. And it's ironic that you say something very similar that we heard David Bailey say a couple of weeks ago on our show as well, where he went, you know, we are covering ordinals, for example, for this exact reason. Yes, you can maybe make the assumption of the investment scheme behind it. But, you know, again, businesses need to generate money to stay afloat. So they decided to opt in for that path. And hey, if it doesn't pay out, we were wrong. We're big enough to say, okay, we fucked up. We'll move on. And I guess the whole layer debate will go the similar fashion, at least for the foreseeable couple of cycles, probably.
Yeah, I don't like JPEGs on a blockchain. I don't want to buy one. I'm just not interested. But that doesn't mean other people aren't allowed to be interested in that. Dude, it's if we are all about freedom, I think we should, you know, live to that and let people do whatever they want to do. Like, okay, if you want to pay one Bitcoin for one sat, hey, man, be my guest. I don't really care. I'm never going to do that. But if you find something valuable, I used to collect basketball cards when I was a kid. And in my adult life, I also tried to get serious into flipping sports cards. I totally understand the not necessarily only the value of something, but just the culture, the identity, you feel like you belong to a community that are cool, that are special, and hey, be my guest. But I myself, I don't care, and that's the only thing I should care about, what I do. So. Whether ordinals becomes a thing in 5 or it still exists 5 to 10 years from now, if they do, I don't know. Then it's just another use case on Bitcoin. I really don't think people should spend so much time thinking about it. It's, the technology is sound in the way that a transaction goes through, right? It gets validated like any other transaction. So that's pretty much it. Code is law. And whatever personal opinions or flavors or preferences people have, hey man, mind your own business. Like, honestly, just let people do whatever they want to do. People do the most stupid shit every single day. Are you going to be like the police and go out, like, you know, open the window and scream at people at the street if you think they do something that you find is stupid or not wise? I mean, come on. It's it's more of a thing where people need to go outside and touch grass more than anything.
Yeah, 100, Fernando. I'm completely with you on that one, for sure. And you mentioned Mercury Layer, and I'd be amiss not to mention a friend of mine, Nicholas Gregory, who's doing some fantastic work over for Mercury Layer. We're going to close the show now, but before we do, we always love to do the All Roads Lead Back to Bitcoin challenge, where we challenge each of our guests to prove that all roads do in fact lead back to Bitcoin by giving you a word and or phrase that you have to then try and lead it back to Bitcoin. So seeing as you're coming over here to good old Blighty, the UK, shortly, we thought fish and chips might be a good thing to ask you to try and relate back to Bitcoin somehow. So Fernando, have a second and think, how does fish and chips relate back to Bitcoin?
Cool, damn. You probably have the answer because you probably thought about this super hard, haven't you? Fish and chips and Bitcoin.
Mm.
They're yellow and nice and crispy. I love the feeling. I love the feeling of a fresh sat in my wallet. That's kind of like when you take the fish out of the fryer. It's like sizzling and nice, has the right color. And that's really, really bad. I absolutely have no clue, man. The only connection between fish and chips and Bitcoin is I'm going to fucking devour a lot of fish and chips when I come to England.
And I'll show you a nice little spot. I know that you might be able to buy some fish and chips with some Satoshis if you're willing to part with them anyway. So, Fernando, mate, it's been brilliant. Is there anything you want to shill or mention before Joel closes?
No, if you're interested in following the mainstream media's coverage of Bitcoin, go to bitcoinperception.com or just Google Bitcoin Perception. If you want to check out what we're doing over at Blockstream, go to blockstream.com. Get familiar with all our products and see if anything's there is of your liking. And that's it. Follow me on Twitter if you want to catch some retarded ass tweets at BaseLayer.
That's a good username, actually.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of that.
Yeah.
Nice. Fernando, it was lovely having you on. Thanks for your finite time and for all of our listeners' finite time. And as always, stay curious.